Hey, Brian.
Hey, Vic.
How you doing?
Hanging in. How about you?
Hanging in. You're listening to Game Federer, a podcast where Brian and I relive and revisit every Roger Federer Grand Slam title. I'm Vic Singh. Today, we're looking at 2004's Australian Open, where Roger picked up his second Grand Slam title. Brian, Agassi was the defending champ coming in. He played an epic five-setter, which I want to talk to you about. This tournament also featured a pretty pedestrian red shirt, black stripe look for Federer. Still not quite in his full goat regalia, if you will. Also, the Australian Open courts were green, which kind of threw me off for a second. I thought I was watching a different tournament when I was looking back at the YouTube videos. It's not blue that we're accustomed to now. Do you know when that changed?
Changed in 2008. And at this time, everything on hard court was still green. The US Open in 2004 was still green. That changed over in 2005. And with Australia, they actually changed the entire surface. They went from one surface to another. They wanted a more consistent bounce. They wanted more consistent pace. And with that, they were able to come up with an entirely new color. They also thought it was cool because Australia in January, Melbourne is scorching hot. It's the middle of summer there. So they thought this might cool things down a bit. And also the cynical side might say that in many of these cases, when they change colors, you can usually link up with some kind of paint company. I know the US Open did with, I think, Valspar a couple of years ago, and you can come up with a clever name for your specific shade of court paint that your new court now looks like, and it's great, and everybody wins.
Brian, the first thing I want to look at today was the distinction between Grand Slams and other tournaments. There actually is a tennis regular season, if you will. Can you talk about the tennis season generally?
Sure. It's basically January 1st to December 31st, but no, it's very long. You could find tennis pretty much any day of the year, but there is a rhyme and reason to it. Essentially, the first way to think about it is they're chasing the sun. So wherever it's summertime, there's going to be tennis played. So the year starts in, okay, usually tournaments will start play December 30th, December 31st in some warm weather places in the Middle East. There'll be a tournament in India around that time usually. And then the Australian summer, a lot of tournaments in Australia throughout the country. It's that whole summer of tennis in Australia that builds to the Australian Open, which is the first of the four majors: Australia, French Open, Wimbledon, and the US Open. Now, we're speaking really about the men here, as this is our Roger Federer-focused Game Federer podcast, but you've got the nine Masters tournaments, the Masters 1000. They start in March in the U.S. You've got Indian Wells, then you've got Miami, then they go on the clay, Monte Carlo in April, and then they stay on the clay with Madrid and Rome, and then they take some time off until August. You come back and you've got Canada and Cincinnati. Those lead into the US Open. You go to Asia in the fall with Shanghai for the men, and then you close things up indoors with Paris-Bercy, and then the top eight will play the year-end finals. They've been known by different names over the years. They're now called the ATP Finals with a corporate sponsor in front. At the time, I think that this was the Masters Cup, the ATP Finals for the top eight, but that's the meat of the year. Now, every other week, you've got 500 level or 250 level tournaments. Those numbers distinguish how many points are up for grabs for the winner. So that is how the year breaks down. You can go down to the challenger level, which a lot of guys will do to win matches, make money, earn some points, boost the ranking. It's all predicated on the ranking, but that's roughly how the season flows.
What are some other important tournaments besides the Grand Slams? Give me your top two, three, or four that are equally important. I know that the BNP Paribas in Indian Wells is considered like the fifth Grand Slam. I think that has to do with money. But what are some of the other important tournaments out there versus ones that are considered tune-ups?
Well, it depends really for each player. Federer now here in 2020, Djokovic, Nadal, they're gearing their year towards the majors. I mean, that's the priority for these guys. Whereas if you're somebody who's 22 years old and you're trying to build the ranking, a nice run at a major is going to be great because it's going to get you a lot of money and a lot of points, but you need consistency week in, week out at the 250 level, even going up to the 500 level tournament. So yeah, the BNP Paribas Open at Indian Wells, that's huge. Then a lot of it also depends on the surface. I mean, here in the US, we haven't produced a ton of great men's clay quarters in the last 25, 30 years. So there's less emphasis placed on tournaments like Rome and like Madrid, and to a lesser extent, even the French Open, which doesn't get the play that the other three do get.
Why is that?
I think it's just people aren't as invested in it when the Americans don't go as well on the men's side. Now, clay court tennis, I think, is the best kind of tennis to watch just because of how much slower it is, how much more physical it is, how much more of a test it is. And instead of just hitting the ball as hard as you can and that person is going to win, there's so much more that goes into constructing a point. So I think that's great. A tournament that's really popular, certainly among the players, is Cincinnati, which is a Masters level event. It's played, early August, right before the US Open. There's tournaments going into the US Open. It's the last real big tournament where everybody will be there. And it's not even in Cincinnati proper. It's in Mason, Ohio. It's right across from an amusement park. And you might think, okay, the ATP Tour, the WTA, they go to these glitzy Monte Carlo, Miami, these fancy cities. Mason, Ohio, why do people like that so much? And apparently it's just a really well-run tournament, which the players and everybody involved really like. But it is a way to catch your breath before you go on to the tumult of New York City and the US Open, and everybody really enjoys going there. So for me, I like those kinds of tournaments. I've worked at the City Open in Washington. That's a really cool tournament because it's a 500 level event, but it's an old small stadium in a DC public park. So you're right up on top of the players. It's a great place to see some really big name guys, but all over. And if you ask 10 people, you're going to get 10 different lists. Each player is going to have their list based on, oh, I really like the hotel at that tournament. They want their home tournament. It's different depending on where you are. But for Roger Federer, I mean, two staples, or the staple of his year, the Swiss Indoors in Basel in the fall at the end of the year. He was a ball boy there when he was growing up as a kid. Now every year he goes back and plays that tournament, buys all the ball kids pizza. It's a big party. They love seeing him, and it looks like he loves seeing them just as much. So everybody's got their own highlights of the schedule, but week in, week out, and really any time of the day across multiple time zones, you can find some sort of tennis, which I think is one thing that makes the sport really unique.
This is sort of like a layman's question, but like, are there any of these other tournaments, like Cincinnati, for example, Indian Wells, obviously, that could like get into the club of a Grand Slam, or will there only always be four Grand Slams? Can there be more?
That's a really good question. And I think in a lot of ways, Indian Wells is already there. There's never going to be, I don't think they're going to say this is a fifth major.
But it's only three sets. They only play three sets in that tournament.
That's one. Yeah. So I don't think they're ever going to change that. But in terms of the prize money, the crowds,
cachet,
the attention paid on it, the cachet, exactly. I think that is up there. That's certainly the closest. But I don't know if anything's ever going to come closer than that. Larry Ellison owns that tournament. He's a very wealthy person, so he has spared no expense.
I think he's the fifth right now.
Yeah, that's pretty, he does pretty well. He spared no expense in turning that into really just a first-class destination, which has made it more impressive for everybody. It's become really a favorite. They call it tennis paradise. That's their marketing language, but it really does ring true. So that's the closest, but I don't see anything, barring something cataclysmic happening, I don't see anything officially being called the fifth major.
Okay. I've always wondered that. Do you attribute Indian Wells' success largely to Ellison? Like before him, was it pretty much like a whatever tournament?
No, it wasn't a whatever tournament, but it's been such an arms race over the last 15, 20 years, especially with the emergence of big cities in Asia trying to get into the mix here. And then the golden era of men's tennis and women's tennis with Serena Williams, Venus Williams, Sharapova, the personalities in the game has made this such an in-demand thing. So yeah, Indian Wells was always big, but it's massive now. Ellison has been a big part of that. The timing on the calendar has been a big part of that, where it's the perfect way to kick off what they called the Sunshine Double with Indian Wells in Miami. Miami used to be the bigger tournament, but Indian Wells has passed that in a lot of ways. Miami, they did a cool thing in 2019 where they moved the tournament from its home on Key Biscayne, which everybody liked, but it was a little bit past its prime, needed a lot of work. So they now play that tournament inside of Hard Rock Stadium where the Dolphins play, and they build a bunch of smaller courts outside the main stadium, and they set up a stadium court inside the NFL stadium where they have the Super Bowl this year. So that's a cool thing they're doing, but Indian Wells is the juggernaut right there. It has come out on top of this arms race.
I want to talk to you about the importance of the number one ranking. That's part of the storyline of this tournament in particular. Besides the obvious, right? Pride, seeding. What does it actually mean? Like, my extension to that is, what's wrong with being ranked 2 or 3 or 5 or 10 or even the 13th best player? Like, what are the actual implications of that? Because Roger Federer was very sort of ebullient, and getting the number one ranking in this tournament was almost a bigger deal to him than winning the tournament itself, at least by the way he talked about it in press releases and whatnot.
I agree with you 100%. That's something I wanted to talk about as we move down the road here. But why is number one so important? Money is a great way to start there, because the opportunities available to you in terms of endorsements. Now, you're going to get the same amount of prize money, but if your agent can go up to name your brand here and say, okay, here's my guy, he's number one in the world, do you want to work with him? You're going to command a few more dollars than if, okay, here's a nice player, he won Wimbledon last year, sure, he'll do just fine marketing endorsement wise. But if you're the number one in the world, that's bigger. And then a lot of it,
it's branding.
Well, branding, but it's also pride. These guys are intense competitors. So if you get up to 5, you want to kick the door down and get to 1. The real big one, you want the year-end number one, because we'll talk about Murat Safin later. He had 9 weeks at number one over 2 different years, but you want that end-of-year number one. You get your picture on the media guide the next year. They give you a big trophy. You know, a few years ago, Andy Murray finally broke through and took over that year-end number one to close out 2016, and that was such a magnificent accomplishment for him, and you could see what it meant for him once he finally... Yeah, he's a smart guy and knows that, okay, he's not going to have the haul that the other three have in Nadal, Djokovic, and Federer, but just to have that year during that time when all these guys are active, he finished the year at number one. That was such a huge deal to him.
Well, that explains now why after Wimbledon, Roger's first Wimbledon, the one that we did last episode, he couldn't get the number one ranking. He finished 2003 with the 2 ranking, and a bit of a deal was made about that. And now I kind of understand why. But here's my thing. So the money part aside, and the cachet of being able to go to an agent and be able to go to a Nike or to be able to go to Rolex and like, you know, talk your price up. In my mind, it's not quite like basketball, right? When you have a 1 seed and you have an 8 seed, there you have a clear competitive favorite, right? You're going to put all your money on the 1 seed. But in tennis, I feel like if you're ranked 1 or if you're ranked 8 or 9, the outcome is less certain. Is that fair?
Extremely fair. And that's what makes it so complex, where the number is based off what you've accomplished over the last year. So that doesn't, if you've had a bad couple of weeks, but let's use a time on the tennis calendar. Let's say I won Indian Wells in March of 2018, for example. So I've got all those Indian Wells points on my ranking. They're giving my ranking a huge boost. Let's say the back half of that year, I did really poorly. Now, the early part of the following year leading into Indian Wells, I know that all those Indian Wells points are coming off my ranking if I don't win the tournament again or do well again and defend the points that I earned last year. So that time leading up to it, it's the person with a higher ranking in a situation like that who's going to be under more pressure. And you see that happen a lot. And it's almost a relief that once they get past that and all those points come off and their ranking drops, okay, yeah, that's not ideal, but they can at least not have that number, that high number hanging over them, and they can just focus more on the task at hand of playing tennis.
Coming into this Aussie Open, Roddick was ranked number one. And winning this Australian Open, well, actually winning the semifinal of this Australian Open, gave Roger the number one ranking, and he held it for a record 237 consecutive weeks after that. Brian, do you see that record getting eclipsed?
No, I think that's one of, and we talked about this in the first episode, there are some nuanced things. I wouldn't call that, you know, that much time at number one nuance, but there are certain things about Federer beyond the 20 Grand Slam titles that I think get overlooked in terms of how impressive they are. That is absolutely one of them. To be able to do that and to fight off all the challenges for as long as he was able to do that, that's incredibly impressive. When you are the guy with a target on his back every single week, week in, week out, and you're able to hold it off for that long, I don't see that being broken anytime soon, which in a lot of ways is a testament to the depth of the game. But you would have to think about it. I mean, Roger Federer here, when he took over, he was 22 years old. So you've got to get a guy who's going to take the number one ranking at a really early age. Now, tennis since 2004 on the men's side has changed, where guys are winning later and later. It's taking longer to get that breakthrough. So you've got to now get the breakthrough early and keep it early. Whereas now we're seeing guys get that number one ranking when they're older. So it's going to be even harder for them to hold on to it for that much longer. So I don't see this being broken anytime soon.
That's a great point. And they're winning later and later because these quote unquote old guys are still dominating the field, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
So Brian, tournaments he won is the focus of our inquiry here. But I think the story about the ones he didn't win during his reign are equally important, right? So, like, who won Grand Slams when Roger didn't? That's an equal part of this story here. It's an interesting deep dive, if nothing else. The 2003 U.S. Open, that was the Grand Slam that followed the Wimbledon that we just did. Roddick won that one. And that, correct me if I'm wrong, that was his only Grand Slam, right?
Only one, yep.
The only one. Wow. And he did not play Roger Federer in that final. Roger Federer went out in the fourth round to one of our low-key favorites so far of this podcast, David Nalbandian, four sets. Nalbandian lost the first set and then took the next three. I was actually at the third round match against James Blake at the U.S. Open that year with my, she was my girlfriend, but now she's my wife. And we remember rooting for Blake. It was a very pro-Blake crowd, but we were watching Federer with shock and awe. And I, along with most of the other people, we weren't really sure whether it was permissible to jump out of our seats for some of his shots because it was a late night game. And I didn't really know who he was. And I was just watching these cross-court forehands. And I was like, whoa, how is he doing that off balance? Like, how is he, where does he generate that power from? And, you know, this is a story that we're going to continue to talk about going forward here. But agree or disagree, I think it's a good exercise to look at the finals that he wasn't a part of, because it weaves into this narrative of who's coming up behind him for that number one ranking that you just mentioned. And also, like, where did he fare in those tournaments? Like, where did he get knocked out?
Yeah, and he lost, as you said, Vic, to David Nalbandian in the fourth round. And a lot of what there's this massive butterfly effect, which you alluded to. So, okay, Federer doesn't win. Instead, Nalbandian goes on to get to the semifinals where he plays Andy Roddick. He's up two sets to love on Roddick in a third set tiebreak. So he's points away from getting to the U.S. Open final in straight sets. Roddick comes back in that tiebreak, wins the fourth set, wins the fifth set, into the final, wins the final in straight sets. If Roddick doesn't recover in that tiebreak, who knows if he ever wins a major title? There are so many things, so many what ifs that could have gone the other way with just a few bounces of the ball that paint a completely different picture. I mean, Andy Roddick finished 2003 as the world number one. We talked about the importance of being the world number one. He got there in large part on the back of winning the U.S. Open. Federer had chances to take over the number one ranking that summer on, I forget if it was Cincinnati or Canada, but he played Roddick and admittedly was extremely nervous because he knew what was on the line, lost the match to Roddick. Roddick keeps the number one ranking, wins the U.S. Open a couple weeks later, but by the skin of his teeth gets through that semifinal over Nalbandian. So who knows what happens if anything in that thing I just laid out goes the other way.
So 2004 was Federer's year. Three Grand Slams, right? Aussie, Wimbledon, and the U.S. Open. He's the first to do that since Mats Wilander in 1988, who beat Pat Cash in the Australian Open. Cash is a story point in this Grand Slam, which I'll get to down the line here in a minute. French Open, he beat Henri Lecomte. And the U.S. Open, he beat Yvon Lendl. So the only Grand Slam he didn't win, talking about Federer now, was the French. And my default thought was that the first time that Nadal won? No, it was Gaston Gaudio. And I remember watching that match and I was like, oh yeah, I think that's the only Grand Slam he ever won, correct?
Absolutely. This was the time with a lot of guys, the pre-Nadal era. There's a lot of people who just sort of those, you don't call them one slam wonders, but they get hot, win the French Open. That's the tournament that sets itself up to do that the best in the era before Nadal. And Gaudio is a good example of that.
Yeah, I noticed that the French Open is pre-Nadal was a tournament that would have different winners every year. That tournament in particular had an Argentine-heavy final week. Three out of the four semifinalists were Argentines. Brian, in your estimation, who's the best Argentine player?
Well, you probably say in terms of accomplishment, Guillermo Vilas back in the 70s, because he finished number one for a couple of years, won some majors. Recently, it's certainly Juan Martín Del Potro in terms of talent, but he's been the great what if with injuries, which have been really unfortunate. He ended the Federer run at the U.S. Open, another one of those what ifs that we talk about. Maybe Federer makes it six U.S. Opens in a row in 2009, getting ahead of myself here. But that was the only major title Del Potro's ever won. I don't think anybody on that day would have said 11 years later, this is going to be it for Juan Martín Del Potro. He's not going to win another major title, and he's been to finals. He's still trying to get out there, so he could break through again. But that goes to show you how you never know. So he's got the booming, talented gift from God forehand, but he has not been blessed with the health that Roger Federer and so many others have enjoyed in this last decade.
Prime Del Potro, prime Safin, no wrist injuries. Who you got?
Wow, that's really good. Wow, that's a good one.
They're both giants.
Yeah, they're both giants, and they both crush the ball. Safin, a little bit better off both sides, but Del Potro, his shots have had to change because of the injuries, so that's sort of a cause and effect thing. I'll say Del Potro because he has a more even temperament than Safin did, to put it one way.
I like that. That's, you're getting into the head of them now. I did.
Yeah.
That,
so if,
which
if,
is important. Absolutely.
Yeah. That would be a fascinating one to see though.
If Del Potro's first serve is on point, then I got him too. It's all about that first serve for both of them, I feel like, but, that would have been a fascinating match for the ages. Did they ever play? I don't think they ever played against each other in a significant, Grand Slam.
Yeah. I don't think at a high level, just because of the timing. Yeah.
Let's do Roger's path to the final versus Safin's path to the final. Let's start with Safin. He had to go through, he was unseated, which is, again, I want to give a lot of props to Safin. I kind of fell in love with him in that Grand Slam against Sampras. I was like, wow, I was kind of waiting for like some new tennis at that point because I was always an Agassi guy over Sampras. So it didn't really hurt me as much that he lost that final. I was kind of interested in like, what's the next thing going to be? And I thought it was Safin. Had those injuries that you mentioned last time. Here he's unseated and he has to go through Todd Martin in five sets. He was up two sets to one. He had to extend that to five. He has to go through James Blake in the fourth round. I don't know how many sets that went. I think, but it was a match.
That was four. Yeah. A couple tie breaks.
With tie breaks. Exactly. Then he has to go through Roddick, number one, and then number four, Agassi. Isn't it incredible road to the final, to say the least?
Not just that, Vicky, you start in the third round there. His first and second round matches went four sets. He did not play a straight set match on his road to the final. So, and that became very evident in the final because he just looked gassed, but he had to fight and claw to get there. As you said, he was unseated because he had the wrist injury the year before. So he had to spend a lot of time off the tour. He's a major champion by this point, that US Open you mentioned when he beat Pete Sampras in 2000, this is now 3.5 years later. So he's trying to break through again. And this is certainly a hard path to travel, but he did travel it to get to that final.
I want to jump to the Agassi match with him. Fascinating look back. I watched a couple of different like recap clips on this. He had 30 aces against Agassi coming in to the final against Federer. I think Federer, he only had three aces. There's a massive discrepancy there. And it took Agassi five sets. Safin looked so powerful, domineering, and unbeatable coming into the final. I was actually kind of afraid for Federer, looking back at this. Like, this guy's going to crush Federer. That's what it looked like in the semifinal. And it just fell apart, you know, in the final. It's a tale of two matches, which I think you've seen in your experience. But, like, just comment on that. How do you do that semifinal match at night and then come into a final where he's getting, I don't know if it's McEnroe or whoever was commentating, was actually kind of making fun of him for tying his shoes so many times. Like, he's nervous or he's trying to not get on the court. What happened?
Well, in many ways, that's the enigma that was Murat Safin, because he had so much talent, but then for whatever reason, he wasn't always able to put that on display, be it health, be it motivation, be it just whatever was going on between his ears. It would fluctuate at times. And I think that's something that is really impressive about Federer, about Nadal, about Djokovic, that it's very rare when they have those kinds of hiccups. Now, they're never really rarely going to have a kind of hiccup like Safin had going from that semifinal over Agassi to the final over Federer. But in a lot of ways, what it is it's just such a, it's really hard to fill that tank back up. When you get into a major final with a 5-set semifinal win over Andre Agassi, it's a grueling match. To then come back 2 days later and get up again, when you already feel like, okay, I accomplished something here, which he certainly did, but to now do it again in the final, it's really hard to do. And then once that first set goes in the final, it gets even harder. There's not much left in the tank. You're running on fumes, and I think that's what we saw on court that day.
Observations I had from the Agassi match. Agassi had him running all over the court, like Agassi is wont to do with his opponents. But Safin still won points. He had these amazing down-the-line backhands. Kudos to Agassi, though. He lost the first two sets, but kept fighting all the way, which is something I want to ask you about him in general. His returns were legendary. You know, this was, again, pre-Djokovic, so he is the best returner in the game at this point. And I think the broadcasters even said that multiple times over during this match. The point of the match for me was a Safin overhead slam from behind the baseline, which was just incredible. I think it was 3 feet behind the baseline, which was incredible to be able to get the angle on that shot right over the net. The tail of the tape, if you will, for Safin was, it was his first serve, which did not serve him well in the final, and the two-handed backhand winners down the line. This match, pardon me for the Rocky analogy here, Safin was Ivan Drago. Agassi was Rocky, but in this movie, Drago won, but he did it with great humility at the end. They had a great exchange. But Brian, are you surprised that Agassi was able to pretty much go toe-to-toe with him looking back?
I'm really not, because it's Andre Agassi, who's one of the greatest players of all time, and he's so good at being able to counterpunch when he needed to, at being able to generate offense when he needed to. So it's what we talk about a lot with Federer, how he can absorb what the other guy is doing. Andre was very good at doing that as well, and I think we saw that in that semifinal. So he didn't quite have it on that day to get over the line against Safin, but he was able to at least take him to 5 sets, come back from 2 sets down. The other thing to remember with Agassi at this time was how hot his hand was in Australia. So he had won in 2003, the year prior, didn't play it in 2002, won it in 01. So he had won the tournament the last two times he was there. Going into that semifinal, he had 26 consecutive match wins. So he was the hot hand in Australia. He knew what he was doing at that tournament. It was just Safin at that point just had that little bit extra.
Let's take a look at Fed's path to the final. A lot of interesting matches here. Fourth round, he plays Leighton Hewitt. Hewitt takes the first set. Federer wins it in 4. Quotables from the broadcast describing Federer. You've got body blows. You've got the word clinic. You've got the expression target practice. One point on Hewitt's serve. He withstood, Federer did, 2 overhead slams to finish with a winner, which is ridiculous. All Hewitt can do is stare at his racket. It was a great visual of him. Like, as the ball is blowing past him, he just looks at his racket. I think it says a lot about their head-to-head going forward after that. Then again, later, also on Hewitt's serve, he defends, Federer does, controls the pace, defends two potential Hewitt winners that against any other player would have been winners. Okay, that's kind of what I want to say here. Then he finishes with his own cross-court winner, after which he promptly sprints to his chair. I don't know if you remember that. His hair's flying everywhere. Normally, Federer keeps his hair pretty under wraps, but he was even marveling at himself at that point. I think he was kind of getting to the buying into his own legend a little bit here. But the nice capstone to this match is that he wins it with an overhead slam. And I think the head-to-head for that pair of then 22-year-olds is pretty set. Agreed? Hewitt is pretty much resigned to his fate against Federer going forward.
I don't know if he was resigned to his fate at that point, but it did not work out well for him after that because they had played so many times being the same age going into this Australian Open. So the year before, one thing I left off the tennis calendar we were speaking about earlier, you've got the Davis Cup, the team competition representing their countries. And that was a huge thing for Federer trying to win. It took him a while for Switzerland to win the tournament. In 2003, they played the Davis Cup semifinal in Australia, Switzerland, Australia as a semifinal. Hewitt beats Federer. Australia went on to win the Davis Cup that year. So that was the last time these two had met, just a few months earlier. But here on this day, for Federer to get that win, and I think this is a key moment when we talk about how this is one of those historic years for Federer with the three majors. We'll get to Hewitt again down the road at a major. But it solidified him atop that heap of players around the same age as him. David Nalbandian, Leighton Hewitt, Andy Roddick, all those guys who are about the same age. We talked in the 2003 Wimbledon episode, you know, okay, Federer wins Wimbledon, but is he going to be the guy or is he just somebody else who got hot and won a tournament? But now this was Federer this year asserting himself and saying, this is my time. We're in the Federer era. I am here to run things essentially. And I think this kind of win over Hewitt was a big step in that direction. And then, as you said, the results certainly after that, because from 2004 Australia on, Federer did not lose to Hewitt again until 2010, 6 years later, on grass, ironically. It's a tournament Federer's won 10 times now at Halle. But Hewitt actually beat him in that final, came back from a set down. But before this, it was 50-50. Maybe Hewitt had a slight advantage, but this is Federer saying, no, I'm here. This is my time. And that's why I think this tournament is one of those that you circle as one of the more important victories in Federer's career.
And he's doing it against everybody, right? He's like, give me the fastest player on the tour, I'll beat you. Give me the strongest player on the tour, I'll beat you. Give me the best two-handed backhand guy on the tour, I got this. He's doing it against anybody and everybody, and I think that's what sort of levels sort of the competition. Let's jump to the quarterfinal with Nalbandian. To me, it's a sad thing that he never won a Grand Slam. He's a worthy Grand Slam person, if you will. He's one of the players that should have had one. I read a little bit about his personal life, and there were some press articles on this newspaper.com subscription that I've been diving into about how he was kind of like an Agassi figure. He kind of had a love-hate relationship with the game. I didn't know that then, but let's talk about the match, and then maybe you can weigh in on what I just said. It was a four-setter. It was revenge from the U.S. Open 2003, where Federer lost. I gotta say, though, Nalbandian won the hair matchup. Picking up from our last chat, Nalbandian's hair was on fire this tournament in particular. But I want to emphasize this again. I don't know how many more times we're going to be talking about Nalbandian and the Federer story. His backhand is like a paintbrush, Brian. He does whatever he wants with that thing. He moves the opponent around as he pleases, and he did that with Federer. He moved Federer around. There were a couple of points where Federer was going places where he didn't want to go. He wasn't dictating the point, in other words. In this match, we get some great looks at Federer falling backward off balance to hit forehands, which is something that I want to hear about from you. Part of me thinks that was Nalbandian making him uncomfortable, but also, this became a signature shot for Federer, falling backward, off balance, and hitting these cross-court nasty forehands. David Foster Wallace wrote about it. What can you say about that shot in particular, and did it have a renaissance, if you will, in this Nalbandian match?
Well, I don't know if he brought it out of him, but it's an interesting way to think of it. And you do see guys raising their games based on what everybody else is doing. And in terms of players Federer knew, Nalbandian at that point had to be high on that list. These guys are the same age, so they were top juniors at the same time. They played in the U.S. Open boys final in 1998. That was Nalbandian winning over Federer. So here's a guy that Federer knows. He's seen him. He's lost to him. He's beaten him. So you start to think about, okay, I don't need this shot to beat David Nalbandian. You're not going to think about it that way, but you're going to think, I'm going to be in this situation where I need this shot, be it against David Nalbandian or be it against a guy who maybe right now is 5 years old, but in 12 years, 13 years, when I still want to be out here, I'm going to need to develop this. And the evolution is something that these guys have not stopped. So did he bring that out of him? Maybe, but maybe it's just Federer realizing, okay, this is what I need to do to compete at this high level.
It's never made sense to me. He generates power when he should be doing the opposite. The physics don't add up, doesn't make sense, but it is one of his signature shots. He runs, like he almost runs to the point where he gets around the ball to hit that forehand, and he does it so quickly and so deftly that if you're not paying attention, you miss it. But it's a shot that should otherwise be a backhand, is my point. But he makes it into a forehand, and he generates power on top of that, or torque, or whatever you want to call it. It's a beautiful thing, and he did it so well and elegantly against Nalbandian.
It's the anticipation that he has in spades. That's never gone away. And it's not just the foot speed. Yeah, he's fast. Is he as fast as Nadal? Is he as fast as Andy Murray? No, but he's quick. The anticipation is so good. There's no wasted movement. And he always gets himself into the right spot. And it's a being able to do that, you're able to put the front foot forward and create offense instead of just trying to react, get there, block it back, and play defense. You're able to put a little more attacking intent into the point.
To your point, it felt like in this match and going forward that Federer was toying with Nalbandian, not in a bad or sinister way, but in a like, give me all you got and I'll give it right back. However, one shot where Nalbandian ruled the day and makes me a perennial all-time fan of his was, and I think I mentioned it to you last time, was his jumping two-handed cross-court backhand winners. And he does it in this match in particular and actually helps him secure a third set. And I think he won that 7-5. One thing I noticed and I enjoyed on the broadcast was how much John McEnroe does not like the one-legged backhand. He has such a huge problem with that. He kind of sounds like the old man, get off my lawn kind of a thing, but he complains about it with Safin in the final, and it becomes a bit of a thing.
Yeah, the one leg. I don't think it's necessary. I think it's more for flair.
Okay, you think it's flair too. Okay, see, I think there's a science behind it. You think it's flair.
I think the science is, look what I can do, now take that. So Sebastian Grosjean, who somehow just avoided being on this show because he seemed like somebody who would have played Federer in a major final, he was a good French player around this time, a top 10 player. And I know his coach at the time, Brad Stein, who's a veteran American coach, and Sebastian Grosjean was well known for that. And Brad Stein would say, you know, you kind of pick your spots where, yeah, if you see your player doing that, does it give you the best feeling as a coach? Like, is that fundamentally sound? Probably not, but he's not really hurting anybody. He's not hurting himself. So if he wants to do that, just let him do it. I think it's that has something to do with it. I don't think there's a huge strategic play to it.
Okay. So you've invited me into a basketball reference, and what you're basically describing to me sounds like Terry Stotts and Damian Lillard. He doesn't love that Damian Lillard takes logo threes, but it's something that he works on, and it's something that he practices, and it's a very intimidating shot. So he allows it. You pick your battles, is what you're saying.
Exactly. Exactly.
I love it.
You pick your spots.
A final note on Nalbandian before we leave him. Interesting stat, if you will. He's the only player, Brian, to beat Federer, Nadal, and Djokovic in the same tournament. He did that in 2007 in Madrid.
Yeah, that's an incredible accomplishment, and it's a cool list. Yeah, that's one of those great trivia questions. Also up there, Patrick Rafter, the former Australian great, former number one. He's the only player who's played Roger Federer three times, at least, and has never lost to him. Of course, it was a much younger Federer at that time, but still, that's something I'd be bragging about if I were Pat Rafter.
Hey, man, you might not make the Tennis Hall of Fame, but you can argue for the People's Hall of Fame, right?
Pat Rafter might be in the Tennis Hall of Fame. I mean, he's very good.
Does Nalbandian make the Hall of Fame?
No. Basically, the criteria now is if you win a major title, you're in the Hall of Fame, or barring some extreme examples. If you don't win a major title, that's where it's going to get interesting. If you win a lot, like a David Ferrer type, but Nalbandian didn't quite get to that level. So no, I would not say he's a Hall of Famer.
So Michael Chang makes it, but David Ferrer doesn't.
Yeah, Michael Chang's got a couple majors.
Yeah. Sidebar, unrelated, but does Maria Sharapova make it?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, she has a career Grand Slam, so that's a no-doubter.
Despite the scandal.
Yeah, it's that's a good point, because tennis has not really had, you know, we see that in baseball now. But no, they're not going, Sharapova will be in the Hall of Fame.
They're not going to Pete Rose her.
No, or, well, I think with her, it would be Barry Bonds is the more.
Barry Bonds, yeah.
Similar comparison, but not that Bonds was ever failed a drug test or anything like that, just to say that. But yeah, I would say Sharapova is absolutely a Hall of Famer. Vic, one thing I want to get into as we look at this field that Federer got through, we talked about these big names like Nalbandian, like Leighton Hewitt. Everybody who's listening to this podcast has heard of those guys. But I think it's important because we talked about this in the first episode. When you look at tennis careers and how they can, you can think, okay, this person never won a title, but they were on tour for a couple of years. What did they do? I think we should take a look at some of these guys. And in this case, in this 2004 Australian Open, Federer starts it. He plays Alex Bogomolov Jr., who's an American qualifier. He was a big rising name around this time, and then he was dealing with some stuff off the court and just figuring things out. But then he got really hot about 5 years later, made some nice deep runs at tournaments, eventually switched to his allegiance to Russia, had to pay the USTA some money that they gave him to support, repay them for that. So he wound up having a nice career. But the guy I want to talk about was actually in the third round. And that was a wild card, an Australian wild card named Todd Reed. And the reason I want to talk about Todd Reed, we talked about Federer in the Wimbledon episode as somebody who he won junior Wimbledon, but is he going to come through and win the big tournament? Because you talk about people who they have success in the juniors, but then it doesn't happen at the senior, at the main tour level. And Todd Reed really sadly is one of those examples. He was the 2002 Wimbledon champion from Australia. And at this point, 2004 Australian Open, he was playing the best tennis of his life. He had had a really good Australian summer. He won a challenger, which is the level right below those main tour events. A couple of quarterfinals in the two lead-up tournaments in Adelaide and Sydney. Big five-set emotional win as the hometown young guy in the second round. Then he goes out, loses to Federer. But later that year, he got mono. And well, I don't think he got mono at some point in the next year. And that really hampered him. Injuries then followed. He was never able to get into the top 100, never really able to get his career back going. This was the high watermark. And sadly, he actually passed away a couple of years ago in his early 30s, mid 30s. And as tragic as that is, I think it's also illustrative in just, you never know in this sport, in life, how here's a guy who had all the success as a junior, but it just did not happen for him. In many cases, for reasons outside of his control. So for every junior champion, like a Roger Federer, even a David Nalbandian, David Nalbandian's a top five player in the world. He's been deep at majors. He still had a great career. But for all of those guys, there is unfortunately at times that dark side. And I think we should just kind of be aware of that when we look at these tournaments and just being a professional athlete and all the challenges that come with it.
I'm really glad you actually articulated that. Thank you for doing it. And it's super important. We are talking about the top 10, 15, 20 players in the world. But as you know, probably better than anybody, tennis, amateurs to the pros, it's a messy, imperfect, unfair, brutal business and science. And there are a lot of great players that and the pressure. I mean, and these are young people, right? These are all kids that are spotted at a really young age that are told, hey, you should go see so-and-so, the equivalent of Nick Bollettieri in your town. Go talk to that guy. And they get put into these little vacuums, right? And some of them come out on top. And those are sadly the ones that we talk about. But it's really great that you shined a light on someone that does not get any headlines, but has a story that is a part of Federer's in some small way.
Absolutely.
Really great point. Semifinal. I want to say something about Juan Carlos Ferreira. This is an important match, obviously, for Federer. It gives him his number one rank. But I never found his matches against Juan Carlos compelling tennis. I've watched every Federer match. I'm a huge Federer apologist, as I've told you already. But whenever he played this guy, I kind of like fell back asleep, you know, or if I got up early to watch it or something and he was on, it's sort of sleepy tennis. And that's not to disrespect Juan Carlos at all. He went deep in many, many, many Grand Slams, but Federer just made him look diminished. Is that a fair assessment?
Very much so. And you're not, there's nothing wrong with not having a favorite player to watch. There are a lot of fans, a lot of people. When you look at today's matches and you see certain players playing, they don't excite you as much as other people do. Yeah, I mean, Juan Carlos Ferreira, that year before he had won the French Open, briefly got to the world number one ranking later that year, right around the U.S. Open final when he lost to Andy Roddick. So, yeah, he's a great accomplished career, but is he the most exciting player? Maybe not. And there's no harm in that. Nothing to apologize for.
Just wanted to make sure I wasn't alone. But look, see, this is the thing with me in like rankings, right? And everybody has personal favorites. You always like, you like who you like. That Nalbandian is not as considered as decorated a player as Juan Carlos is a little disappointing to me. That's all.
I mean,
I'll get over it.
In today's game, Vic, I mean, if you ask probably most pros, most people, who do you want to watch the most? They're going to say Gael Monfils. Gael Monfils has had a great career, but he's never won a major. He's never won a Masters title, but he is electrifying on the court. I mean, he could play in the NBA, I think, if he wanted to. So people love watching Gael Monfils. John Isner, a couple of years ago at the U.S. Open, was pretty upset about the fact that here's John Isner playing at his home Grand Slam. He's the U.S. number one, and the crowd supporting Gael Monfils. He's not thrilled about that. You can understand why, but you can also understand why the crowd loves watching Gael Monfils play tennis. And it's just one of those things that these are in many ways artists, and you still, everybody has their personal preference as to who they want to watch.
And he's an entertainer. I mean, look, sports is about entertainment from a spectator's point of view. Looking at all the people behind me at the stadium there, they want to be entertained. You know, they don't want to be lulled to sleep. But yeah, so okay, so that's the semifinal. Every time he plays Roger just dispatches him like quickly. He makes quick work of him and then moves on to the next round. Let's look at some other notable matches in this tournament. You mentioned a couple. I just want to point out some names that fit into this architecture of Roger Federer. Earlier in the tournament, Agassi played Tomas Berdych, who was a qualifier then. Agassi destroyed him. But Berdych, of course, will become a larger part of the Federer journey here. He plays him in several second weeks of these Grand Slam tournaments going forward. So I just wanted to incorporate him into the mix a little bit. And then Hewitt, which we mentioned, played Nadal. In the third round, Nadal was unranked in this tournament, and Hewitt took that one. But, Brian, Nadal's footsteps are looming, sort of the point here, right? He's climbing up. Roger's going to have this sort of window, but it doesn't last long. I mean, he's here at 20, but Nadal was right there. And I would love to get into the psychology of what Roger's thinking. Like, when did he think he was being chased? You know, like, when did he start to believe that he has to start accumulating these things? Or maybe he's so mentally strong that he never even thought that way. But me personally, if I see Nadal over here, I'm immediately thinking, man, I got to start cranking this. So I wanted to bring him into the fold here in 2004. He hasn't obviously won any Grand Slams yet, but he is a figure that's going to loom large in this story.
Yeah, and his footsteps have been looming for some time because he had a big time junior career. When you look at the John McEnroes and the Andre Agassi types, what he did was commensurate with those guys. And he had a lot of success at that level. He played Pat Cash in an exhibition when he was like 15 or 14. And Pat Cash is thinking like, okay, this is just some kid who's going to play. And then I think he beat him in an exhibition. And Pat Cash is like, is this like some kind of joke or something? So here's the Nadal reputation had already been there, that he was a guy. But is Federer thinking about that at that point? Maybe, maybe not. He's probably still concerned. I think the main concern is winning the tournament, getting the number one ranking. But again, to talk about how there's no sure things, I mean, you mentioned Tomas Berdych. He had had a lot of success at this point. He had a really good 2004, so this is just before that really got rolling. But a lot was expected of him, and he delivered. Okay, he never won a major, but he is in the top 10 all-time in prize money, had a great career. So all these guys, there's always something new coming. But are you thinking of this as like a direct threat? probably not at that point.
Tomas Berdych is top 10 prize money. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, Fascinating statistic.
I think we talked about in our first episode about Feliciano Lopez and how he's lost more matches than anyone else. And he's made in prize money, I think, $17 million in his career.
But he's not in the top 10.
No, he's not in the top 10. Berdych, we almost need a name. We talked about David Nalbandian. There's a group of players who would have won majors if they had played in any other era. Nalbandian's in that. Berdych is in that. Ferrer is in that. These are guys who never won a major in many ways because of the era they were thrust into. We almost needed, it's like the David Nalbandian All-Stars or something, but it's...
Hey, I'm okay with that team name.
Yeah, but Nalbandian had chances on the earlier side. Berdych and Ferrer, they were thrust right into it. The Sangas of the world, the Malfis, those guys were right in the thick of it with the golden era of the big three, big four.
Yeah, Sanga's another name. I can't wait to talk about him coming up. So some Federer observations, Brian, that I had looking back at this tournament. In general, a couple of themes from his playing style or sort of aces in his sleeves, if you will. His defensive, slow-paced backhands, okay? Talk about lulling a crowd to sleep. He lulls his opponent to sleep. Are you in agreement with that statement? That's part of his game. It's just, I'm going to keep giving this to you until you think nothing's coming, and then winner.
It's not just that. It lulls the opponent to sleep, but it also gives him more time to, it gives him that extra second to get in position that if he now sees an approach opportunity off one of those slower backhands, taking the pace off of it, he always knows he can inject more pace if he needs to, but if he can take something off of it, that will buy him time as well. And it's just a way to keep them, not so much lulling them to sleep, but just keeping them off balance and never letting them get comfortable into a rally, just those extra options.
Well, to your point, the rallies, right? He's setting up his optimal foot position. I'm going to give you another analogy here. Once he finds his foot position, he smashes a winner wherever he wants it to go. Brian, if we're analogizing to chess, how many moves ahead is he playing compared to his competitor?
That's a good way to think about it. And in a lot of ways, it's hard to directly say compared to chess.
Of course.
But everybody's thinking ahead in tennis, but there's a difference between thinking and being able to actually do it. And he is able to do it almost what seems like anytime he wants. So I think that's, he's two steps ahead. We'll call it that. But it's more that he's able to execute it better than anybody else can.
His synapses are firing, it's fair to say. He's not the fastest, you said, but he's one of the quickest. And I think there's a nice distinction there. Again, getting in a position on a dime to hit a cross-court forehand where it should be for most any other player, a backhand, right? A defensive backhand, he converts it into an offensive forehand. And that is something that I saw for the first time really in this tournament compared to Wimbledon. So it's a theme that I think is as mesmerizing as the next going forward in all of his other matches. Those are my Federer observations. I want to give you some Safin stats and see if anything kind of gets your juices flowing here before we look at the actual final that they played. I think I mentioned this. He's the tallest player ever to be the number one in the world. He's 6'4". That's a pretty cool stat. By the way, Safin's in the Hall of Fame, right? Based on your rubric?
Yeah, Safin's in the Hall of Fame, and he's the first Russian player to get into the Hall of Fame. And I think that has something to do with his legacy because he was the first, you know, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the first player to emerge at a really high level. I mean, you had Kafelnikov and other players, but nobody took things over like Murat Safin did. He had the most popularity out of any of those guys. And then he paved the way, certainly for the women who came behind him. Interestingly, one of those women, his sister, Dinara, also number one in the world, never won a major though, but the only brother-sister duo to be number one in the world. So yeah, he is, I would say, a deserved Hall of Famer.
He won two Grand Slams, and he was most successful at the Australian Open, and he missed a lot of time, as you mentioned, because of that wrist injury. Fascinating thing on him that I learned looking this up, he's now a member of Russian Parliament. He's a politician.
He's in the Duma.
Nice pivot there.
I will say, too, we should give him credit because, yeah, he was second best in this final to Federer. Comes back and wins the tournament a year later, so that second major in Australia 2005, and he beat Leighton Hewitt in that final. So Hewitt every year would go into the Australian Open under immense pressure as the Australian number one, you know.
Yeah.
And that was the only time Hewitt got to the Australian final. So Safin, to deal with all that extra noise, was able to handle it pretty well.
Where did Federer finish in that tournament? And did Hewitt or Safin beat him?
Safin beat, That was the 9-7 fifth set before the tiebreak. Safin over Federer in the fifth set.
So Safin gets revenge the next year.
The next year, yeah.
Interesting. Wow. Let's talk about this final. Safin spent 8 hours on the court, more than Federer coming in. Again, he tied his shoes a lot. Was that nerves, or was that just the media just making something out of nothing? Because it was a thing for the first set. They're talking about his shoes for 3 minutes.
Probably a bit of both. He might have been distracted, might not have been comfortable. So he starts tying the shoes. But then when he ties the shoes, that's going to get noticed by the cameras and everybody courtside. So it becomes a cycle. But yeah, I think the biggest thing in this final was the fact that the amount of time he'd spent on court. We said Federer had lost two sets going to this final. Safin had not played a match that he won in straight sets. All of his matches won at least four sets. He was on court for more than 18 hours. Federer was about 10 hours on court. So Federer's fresh as a daisy going into this match. And you've got Safin coming off the slugfest. Fresh as a daisy is an overstatement because that was a big win over Nalbandian. But Safin, for what he had to get through just to get to the final, totally different story.
Interesting contrast or juxtaposition, if you will. Nalbandian and Hewitt were smaller, softer hitters. And the question coming in is, would Federer be able to go toe-to-toe with Safin? That was what they were talking about, right? Like, is he going to be able to put up, after what Agassi threw at him, what is Federer possibly going to be able to pull out of his bag? But surprisingly coming in, Safin looked kind of tentative. Dare I say intimidated. He goes up a break, actually, in the first set, 2-1. So then the dialogue or sort of the commentary goes to is Federer a little rattled? It was an interesting first set. Normally, these guys don't get broken on their serve, but they both got broken in the first set.
And I think we were talking about, what did Safin have left with all those long emotional wins just to get to the final? But I think at that point, when you could go into the first set, you could have asked the same question about Federer, because he took the court knowing that by beating Juan Carlos Ferrer in the semifinal, he was going to be the new world number one, regardless of whether or not he won the final. So there maybe was that thought at the time of, okay, is Federer still able to now regather himself emotionally, because he fell to his knees after winning the semifinal. That was a huge deal for him just to take over that world number one ranking. And you could see what he did with it. But so I think it was a valid question going in. Is he able to now focus on this final and focus on completing the job, winning this tournament, which we later learned he was able to do.
Part of what makes this incredible to me is, and we talked about it at the very beginning, again, is the contrast with the Agassi match. That was so much faster, that match. And it was five sets, even in the fifth set. By the way, sidebar, are you in the camp that if you get to a fifth set, it's kind of like a game seven? It's anybody's match?
Yeah, for the most part, unless you can see that somebody is really physically spent.
Yeah.
I think you can read it a little bit better going into a fifth set than you could about a game seven, because it's still just one set. Whereas a whole game seven, you've got whatever the sport is, that amount of time to play. So it's a shorter period of time. But yeah, it's the same rough analogy.
Federer basically controls the pace of play in this game. And I think you've articulated this already, that he will, I call it lulling, but he's setting up the right opportunity. Because right, this game, especially at their level, it's a game of inches, if not centimeters, and it's all about getting that one shot through that one crease. But Safin does not look like he did in the semifinal, and he keep coming back to that. But that's sort of what I leave with this tournament is that, yeah, he did have extra time on the court. He was a shell of himself. Does that discount or diminish Roger's victory anyway? Absolutely not. Let me know how you feel about this, but I feel like part of being a Grand Slam champion is not just the final, but how you get to the final, right? How quickly and efficiently and economically you dispatch your opponents. That has to play into the calculus, right?
Absolutely. We talked about that in the Wimbledon episode where so many times you'll see Federer just get on, get off the court, 80 minutes. He works fast. His service games go so fast. Okay, he's not hitting Andy Roddick serves, but the number of service games, it's always fun to watch when there's a clock on a Federer service game. You will see so many service games that are 60 seconds, 55 seconds, 70 seconds, just flies through these games. So it's great for him because he's got the point on the board there. But then all of a sudden, let's say he made the, let's say the opponent held the game before. Okay, great. He held, maybe he had to fight for a little bit. He doesn't get a time to catch his breath. All of a sudden it's here you go again. Have another shot at it. Get back, like try again to hold serve on me. Just not giving, just taking that kind of time away from them.
So Fed wins that first set in a tiebreak. He smokes him in the tiebreak 7-3. And after that, Brian, bottom line, Safin let Federer smell blood. And this is kind of another storyline for Roger Federer matches. Once he smells blood, it's this, the game slows down. And I think I've read somewhere where he was talking to somebody after a match and they were asking him, like, how big did that tennis ball look like to you? And he answered, you know, sort of facetiously in a not in an intimidating way, but he was like, it was kind of like a basketball today. And this is signature Roger. It's a super fast game. And there's a couple of matches with Nadal too, where they're hitting the ball so fast. But when it's on Roger's side, it's almost like you're watching it like that video game. I don't remember what it was called, but there was that one video game where the guy would like jump out of a room and it would be slow motion. I think Mark Wahlberg was in one of the movies of the character, but time slowed down on Federer's side of the ball. And that is another part of his myth.
Yes. And that's just, I think, a player at the top of his game. I think it's basically how you describe that. It's funny you say facetiously, though, with the ball becoming a basketball. I don't think he's being facetious there. And that's something I wanted to get into. We, at this tournament, begin to see the emergence of what I enjoy watching now to this day. Federer has a tremendously healthy ego, and with good reason, because he's won 20 majors, but it doesn't get, you know, people talk about him in a way, you know, Michael Jordan has a great ego. And I think that's why people like him so much, that, you know, these Jordan trash talk stories are legendary. Federer, the things he says, if you read closely, he thinks very highly of his tennis abilities. When he beat Juan Carlos Ferrero in the semifinals here, I think it's an example of what you were just saying. He said, I feel like I'm living the game, because when the guy's going to hit the ball, I know exactly the angles and the spins. I just feel like I've got that figured out. And you'll watch him in his speeches after a major, like, yeah, I just played so well. And he's not wrong. He's not lying. And he's not being a jerk about it. He's telling the truth. And I always get a kick out of hearing him say those things over the years.
So again, here comes the apologist now. I always ascribe it to or attribute it to like this like language barrier. He's not known for the most amazing press conferences or speeches post-match. I think after he won Wimbledon, the first one, I think he said, I don't know if gaffe is the right word, but it kind of was a gaffe where he's like, yeah, I like to watch myself play.
Yeah.
And I hear you on it, but my apologist in me is like, that's just a language thing. He's not really there, but how can you not have an ego is also what I would say. You have to be able to compete at this sport. It's a gladiator sport, for lack of a better comparison. I feel like if you don't have an ego, you're going to get squashed like a bug. Is there any fairness to that?
Absolutely. And especially something that's interesting with tennis. It's not like, you know, if you're on the Lakers and you're playing the Warriors, you go in the Lakers locker room if you're on the Lakers. If you're in the US Open, if you're at the Australian Open, you're in the locker room. All these players share a locker room. So you will walk in. I mean, locker room's huge, but you'll walk in and you'll see the guy that you're going to play that day. By the time it's the final, there's really only two of you left in the locker room because everyone else has lost and gone home. So you need to have that kind of armor up, essentially, to get through these kinds of moments.
Shot of the match for me was after an out ball that was called in for Safin, talking about that ego. Sometimes you get a glimpse, or at least I get a glimpse of Roger's ego when he's on the court and he looks up at his opponent. He kind of gives him an askance side glance. He throws Safin a look after that botched call, if you will. Saffin serves after that point, and before Saffin's racket hits the ball, okay, this is like 0.001 seconds, Brian, Roger shifts his footing, and he gets into a position where he's going to hit a forehand. You can go back and look at it. He makes the move before the serve comes across, before the ball comes across the net. He knew, my point, and to complete your thought, he knew exactly where that ball was going to go based on whatever signal Saffin gave him, and he blasts a cross-court forehand winner, and then he looks at Saffin again, and I call that the Ollie over Liston moment in the match. And the thing is pretty much over at that point. If I'm Kenny Smith in a slam dunk contest, I'm doing this. It's over. It's over. And it was a thing of beauty. I got to say, there was ego in that point, but that was him saying, I got this. And Saffin was pretty much at that point was resigned too. He starts throwing his racket. Mental toughness, I think, is something that you talked about, differentiating him between Juan Martín Del Potro. He kind of shows it here. I think he talks to the crowd at one point, and he tells the crowd, I'm doing the best I can here. That was some content, okay? Especially right now being quarantined, that was some sporting content, Brian, where he's telling the crowd, I'm doing my best. Like Drago in Rocky IV saying, I fight for me. You know, it was awesome.
Yeah, it's usually not good, though, when the player starts getting into a back and forth with the crowd. You see it in today's game, usually with Nick Kyrgios. Some players use it as something of an outlet, like I wouldn't say coping mechanism, but just an outlet. But yeah, the Federer anticipation that you see on those shots, that has been what is so good and is still so good. And it does give him, I like how you called it, that Ali over Liston, just that kind of moment, that signature moment to really exert himself and put his stamp on it.
So the match finishes, it's a three-setter, pretty quick work if you actually think about it. The second two sets, it was Federer largely in control from beginning to end, 6-4, 6-2, chopped him down like Rocky to complete the analogy. Final thought I had, and then we can wrap things up, Ryan, is that there was some buzz about Federer not having a coach this tournament. You mentioned his coach last tournament after they won Wimbledon, after his last Grand Slam, I should say, at Wimbledon. After he won that, they parted ways. And Pat Cash, who's a guy that you mentioned and we also talked about as far as Mats Wilander is concerned, Pat Cash came out publicly and said that Roger would struggle without a coach. What do you make of that? And also, if you can, like, attach some value to a coach and the importance of a coach, and maybe give some context to what Pat Cash meant and also why Roger Federer took umbrage.
I don't know. I think umbrage might just be Federer thinking, hey, I know what works for me. I know my setup that I've got going here, because a tennis player at this level is going to have, you'll hear them thank their team after they win a tournament. And they really do have a team, because somebody, you know, it was probably a little smaller in 2004. But today, I mean, Federer travels with his family. So he's got his wife, Mirka. The kids come with him. The kids have help in terms of nannies and whatever they are. His parents frequently travel. But you've got an agent. You've got a physio, somebody who's going to, you know, work on the body, work on the massage. This is the elite players. Not all these people have this kind of system. And you've got the coach. A lot of times you'll have a hitting partner, too, who's able to just get out there and drill with you, hit with you at practice. So there's a whole setup. A lot of times it's just helpful to have some different eyes come in and take a look at things. That's why a tennis coach, you know, they'll go through the coaches on a quicker level, because, okay, we made some progress working together in this partnership, but, you know, we've probably come as far as we can. So let's figure out what else is out there. Federer at this point, he had won Wimbledon, trying to get the number one ranking. He's a very comfortable guy, at least he seems like, in his own skin. So I think he had figured out, okay, I don't need a coach right now. He worked with several coaches after this down the road. But at this point, I think he felt, okay, I'm fine just kind of doing what I'm doing here and moving on that way.
Do you think it was ballsy?
Yeah, maybe a little bit. I guess, especially when you contrast it with somebody like Nadal, who was so known for working with his uncle, Tony Nadal, for so long. And only until very recently did Tony Nadal essentially retire from traveling year round. So when you look, when you compare it that way, and you've seen some different faces in the Federer box over the years, maybe that just speaks to his confidence in himself, his own self-belief.
Any final thoughts about this tournament?
Yeah, so I think a couple of things worth looking at here. Trivia. Do you know what happened about 12 hours after Roger Federer won this tournament? Cultural event, early 2004.
Early 2004. You got me.
It was Janet Jackson, Justin Timberlake at the Super Bowl, same day.
Say no more.
Yeah, exactly. Cultural time capsule. But we just talked about the team that's around Federer. And I think that, and we talked earlier in this episode about the arms race in tennis that's gone on over the last two decades or so. And I think it speaks to the amount of money. So Roger Federer wins this tournament. He won just under $1 million, $900,000. When he won this tournament in 2017, his check, and these are both US dollar figures, $2.75 million. So if essentially his winner's check tripled in 13 years. That's incredible. When you look at, we talked about the color of the court. Yeah, it's different. But if you watch the tournament now, the other difference is you see, look at the sponsors and the companies that are affiliated with pro tennis. Now, it's always been a certain kind of target audience for tennis. But the Australian Open has really leaned into the last couple of years, the Asian market. It's the Grand Slam of Asia Pacific. So you see a lot of Chinese companies, a lot of Japanese companies sponsoring the tournament and being involved. This tournament, more than any other, I would say looks different when you watch this compared to watching any of the other Grand Slams from the earlier part of Federer's career. The Australian Open is the one that looks the most different, at least to me. It's the same stadium, court's different, services are different, but in terms of the sponsorships, the attention being paid to it, this is the one that just feels the most different.
After this win and his number one rank firmly cemented, is this when the money starts flowing in? Is this when the Nike stuff starts happening? Is this when the Rolex starts happening? Or,
well, Nike was already there. He was wearing Nike, but in terms of making him the guy,
the face.
Yeah, I think we still have to wait a little bit, especially if you're a company like that. And at this time, we said the Australian Open didn't, I mean, it was still one of the majors, but it got less based on the time difference. You know, it's on the middle of the night in the US and in much of Europe. So it's
you have to be a big fan in the States to watch the Australian Open. You got to record it. You got to wake up. You got to, yeah, it's hard.
There weren't as many eyeballs on it. So the money's not, I mean, let's put it this way. The faucet's on, it's not gushing, but there's a nice, the pool is filling up, the pool of money. Let's put it that way. His Scrooge McDuck vault of coins, it was beginning to fill up right here.
Well said. I like how you're kind of painting him out to be like a villain almost here.
he's the guy. He's won everything. He's made a lot of money. So I think you it's helpful to look at it from that perspective.
No, it's actually fascinating what you said about his healthy ego. I've always just sort of glossed over it because I've been enamored with the greatness. But it is something I'm going to pay more attention to going forward. This was a good one. 2004 Australian Open is in the books. Do you know off the top of your head what's next for us?
We're not going too far down the calendar. We're going Wimbledon 2004. One thing that I wonder if I should have just said this, but maybe we should save it for Wimbledon. I think it's better to save it for Wimbledon. What happened after this tournament before Wimbledon? Because he's number one now, but the big thing that happened in that window was he played Nadal for the first time and lost at Miami. So I guess maybe we save that for Wimbledon.
Yes, that's actually a great place to start next time.
Great, good idea.
Let's let Roger have this tournament all to himself, and then we will bring Nadal fully into the fold next week when we talk about Wimbledon 2004. Brian, thank you as always. This has been a lot of fun. Stay well over there in the city. And I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Vic. Stay well to you as well.